Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, there's Zach, there's Ian.
Hey. I'm Ian.
That's Ian. And for the purposes
I'm going to keep doing this till people believe it.
For the purposes of tonight, I will be Zach.
Oh, that'd be interesting. We could do a role play one sometime.
Where we try to take on the other person's character?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So, we got two new ones to talk about. They probably won't be new by the time this is up, but that means, I don't know, I guess we can have more of an in-depth discussion and feel like we can be relatively spoiler-free to a degree. I mean, if this comes up in a month or less...
Well, the thing is, what's the movie that you saw?
See, yeah, it's right. Neither of us have seen the other one. I saw Black Swan, and you saw True Grit.
I saw True Grits.
Grits.
I call it Grits.
And I haven't even seen the original True Grits.
Multiple people have True Grit in it.
Yes. I haven't seen the original with the Duke where he won an Oscar and all that.
Right.
I've heard it's more comedic, though, than this.
Yeah, this one's supposedly more based on the book, though they're both kind of like, they both take tangents, I guess.
Sure. So this is Coen doing another sort of remake adaptation.
It's Rob Coen, who directed Dragonheart.
Yeah, and he also directed XXX, right? And Fast and the Furious.
I think so.
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah. He played the pizza guy in Fast and the Furious.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he was
I just saw
a picture of him like once, and then when I was watching the movie, he was like
Michael Bay usually plays thug number two or something like that in his films.
Nice, that's
or
good.
Like a pizza guy or like someone behind a tank or something like that.
Nice
man behind the tank, you know.
That's
Michael
good.
Bay. Yeah. So it's
they did the adaptation. They wrote the screenplay.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, they always write.
Yeah, I mean, you never know.
The only time that hasn't happened was when they have their names plus, what's his name? Sam Raimi.
Oh, for like...
Hudsucker Proxy, and I don't know what else. I think
Crime
else.
Wave. That was Ed Raimi directed that.
Well, yeah, they wrote that for him, yeah. But
that was not a good movie. You'd think that could be classic.
It's got Bluto in it, right? I think Bluto's in it. From the Popeye movie. Robert Altman.
I don't know.
Trust me.
I put it on and then I started like cleaning a drawer because I was bored with it. And so
was
it like
Popeye?
No.
Crime Wave. Oh, okay.
I could never give Popeye a chance. I'm sorry.
Popeye is pretty weird. It's got really good score, like the soundtrack. The songs
before
it are good. It's weird because it's Robert Altman. But it's Popeye.
Yeah. And it's like...
People just talk over each other film, which is the Robert Altman thing. But it's like, you don't understand what's going on ever.
Because
it's Popeye.
Ka-ka-ka-ka.
And there's, you know, babies being kidnapped.
Okay. So back to True Grit. This Popeye tangent's going to get us again. It gets us every time.
And also, Shelley Duvall.
Shelley Duvall, yeah.
I always want to say Shelley Long. It's not Shelley Long. It's Shelley Duvall. Or not Shelley Winter either. It's Shelley Duvall.
Yeah.
She's just gross. Whoever thought she should be an actor? She's gross.
Well, maybe she
The
she
Shining? They couldn't have done better than her in The Shining?
In what way? Like more attractive?
In every way. Actor, acting, more attractive.
Oh, she kind of did flipped
not,
out. Kind
not
of,
sounding whiny.
That kind
not
of worked.
Being squeaky.
It worked
not
in
having
The Shining.
Huge teeth.
It worked in The Shining. Because you kind of wanted to hit her with a bat in The Shining.
What else was she in before that?
I don't know.
Would have been like, you know who I want? I want Shelley Duvall.
Get
me Duvall.
It's possible, in a weird way, that maybe Kubrick couldn't get everyone that he would have maybe wanted.
Do you think he called his casting director and was like, get me Duvall?
No, I think he probably
and then
got whoever
he thought. He thought he meant Shelley Duvall. He actually meant Robert Duvall. He was just going to put him in drag or something.
Possibly. He was going to be Pigman number one or whatever in The Shining. So yeah, so you saw the Coen remake adaptation of
True Grits,
which you're calling it Grits, because there are many people were gritty.
Multiple
in the film.
People with grits.
Jeff Bridges, Eye Patch.
J. Bridge.
Taking the role from the Duke. And Duke won an Oscar. Do you think Bridges is going to win a second for this?
I wouldn't be surprised if he was nominated. It's an iconic role, for sure. Damon was pretty good.
Yeah, that's right, he's in it.
The girl in it is pretty good.
Has the girl been in anything, or is she kind of an introducing?
Newcomer, some 14-year-old chick. So it's got a strong premise to start with. The girl wants to find her father's killer.
So it's a revenge picture, kind of.
Seems like it's going to be. And then it just meanders. And there's a whole lot of little stops along the way that don't really matter.
Are they building character? Are they doing anything?
Oh, yeah. It's all character building.
So it matters in some
way. And then there's a couple of awesome things in the middle. I was reading, you know, how it had, like, everyone uses the same thing, moments of shocking violence. It truly does have, like, two moments of shocking violence, and when you see them, you'll be like, oh, I'm shocked.
Like Peckinpah kind of stuff?
No, like Coen Brothers type of stuff. And,
You sound like you're trying to defend that you didn't like it that much.
I didn't like it that much. I will give it a positive review at the end. Probably.
Yeah.
It had... There's something about Westerns. They're either done in a way that looks like I feel Westerns should look.
Okay.
It feels like I feel Westerns should feel.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. He's putting in his two cents about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, ever since you got in that armchair, what's he going to do?
Now he's an armchair quarterback.
Uh-huh.
He's armchair quarterback in the Feudal Podcast. He watches some Westerns every now and then.
I'm sure.
With his
grandpa, yeah.
Visually, it didn't feel right?
It's very... You know, like, the woods in Miller's Crossing?
Yeah.
Everything kind of looks like that, except for grayer and deader.
So it's not like the road or something, almost.
Kind of like the road, kind of like... you know, I like that movie, The Proposition, a lot.
Yeah?
But...
That's the Outback. There's a reason that it looks
really,
like that.
Like, dark and grim about it.
Okay.
And this has, for how... You know, for how, like, interesting the characters are, and there are the few moments of humor. You know, there's some decent humor and some good lines and stuff like that. And the Bridges character is constantly saying funny stuff.
Cool.
Damon and the girl are constantly saying funny stuff to each other. It's a very witty conversation in most part between everyone. But it's got such a grim look and feel to it that it's kind of,
it
like,
gets in the way of the story.
It's oppressive. It's a little bit oppressive, and it doesn't really get in the way of the story, but. Add that to the meandering that happens in the second half, to the fact that there's no real antagonist in the film. The Brolin character is the guy she's looking after. And when you meet him, he's kind of dumb and goofy.
Yeah.
And like, which she mentions multiple times, like, you know, before you finally see him, that, like, you know, he's a half-wit, which she's saying to the Damon character, because he's like, oh, I've been chasing him for a long time. She's like, well, I didn't think he was very smart, so basically you suck at what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
And, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of stuff about that, but it ends up being about. I mean, you know, it's hard to say. I think the Coen Brothers. One thing I've been thinking about a lot recently with them is that we give so much credit to them for the films that are almost David Lynch-like in the fact that they have the meaning is not right out there on the surface. Barton Fink.
No Country for Old Men. Even though, like, as you've mentioned multiple times, it's the title of the movie.
Exactly. But that's, I mean, that's also...
But it's not like someone someone comes out there and goes, you know, this here's No Country for Old Men. Though he kind of does that at the end.
It's also a shallow interpretation.
Yeah,
because there's absolutely more in there. I mean, Cormac McCarthy, in his own stuff, has, like, made it clear that everything he does is about death.
Yeah, the, you know, art. It's like, not art unless it deals with death.
Right,
that, kind
that
of
sort
thing,
of thing. And, you know, and of course, you know, they get to that. I mean, everybody dies in No Country for Old Men, essentially, and the guy who doesn't is talking about how he's going too soon and
on his way out.
Yeah. But anyway, so getting to the end of it, it's like this should have been a pretty straightforward film. And because of the meandering and some vagueness about the characters, you know, you don't, though the Bridges characterization is very strong,
yeah,
I feel like there wasn't a lot written into him that made him really someone who would be motivated to do anything in this world.
Yeah.
You know, he tells all through the film, one of the jokes is that he constantly kind of babbles about his past life to the girl who doesn't really seem to care. Now he was married and he tried to run a restaurant and some woman ran off on him and he did some gambling at some point. At one point he tried to rob a bank and you know, like, and that's how the character's written in the books.
Yeah.
Like, he's, you know, he really was that interesting guy and it's more true to life. But the true to life cowboys, you know, the famous ones you think about, they were people who weren't like, I got a strong sense of justice, and I need to... It's nothing like that. It's people who float around from job to job and can just try to make ends meet and try to do something where they could get enough money to buy whiskey and do whatever. Mm-hmm. And the Old West wasn't like it seemed. There weren't shootouts. And, you know, and like Wyatt Earp, you know, his last job was he worked in the movies. In real life. I mean, he worked in movies. He was a consultant for Westerns or something.
That's
and
right.
Did production work and stuff like that.
I think that he was in an episode. We were talking about this off podcast. We were talking about the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and they did an episode where he's with John Ford shooting all the silent ones,
right.
I think they have that at one point. Wyatt Earp is there being a consultant for John Ford or something like that.
But anyway, so I admire them for that. Like, it is real life. It's real life characters.
It sounds like if you have real life characters, but then you put it in a real life story, which is meandery and sometimes lacking in focus.
That's fine if it was a book, but this is a movie.
Yeah, you had to speed it up.
It's an hour and 47 minutes, let's say. It was something a little seriously like
was
that.
It was
an hour
two?
And 50. It was an hour and 50.
Okay, so it was close. But okay.
That said, a movie, I mean, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
You come to expect.
It's that's why I like a lot of TV stuff.
And like
writing for TV is probably the thing I'm going to want to shoot
for. Everyone always has something in their past that leads them to act a certain way. And it makes their actions, you know, gives them a strong motivation.
And it gives some kind of catharsis.
And a good sort of
stuff.
Strong motivation, exactly. It makes for nice character arcs. And it makes for, like in Batman's case, something where it's a constant motivator. It's something you'll never have to worry about going away. You know, one boring thing they always do is, like, you know, what happens to a character once he gets what he wants? You know, like, then suddenly you have to reinvent him. And that seems like a big hassle to even watch. But in this case, it's like, you know, it's real life people doing their thing. And the Matt Damon character is very vain, so that's a good motivator. You know, he's like, he really wants to prove how awesome he is at all times.
That's good. The girl wants revenge, and then it hinges on Bridges, like, why is he there?
Rooster Cogburn is like, well, because he's like, you know, he's no nonsense. And when she finds out, like, there's a line in the beginning where she asks this sheriff, she's like, well, so who can I hire to do this? He's like, well, we can't do it right now. We're worried at this, and there's some people trying to hunt down a certain gang, but there's several U.S. Marshals in town you can talk to. This one guy does it this one way. Rooster Cogburn is kind of, very short-tempered and kind of, like, very murderous. And then the other guy is phenomenal. This other guy is a phenomenal tracker. And one of the smartest and whatever. And she goes, "Where's Rooster Cogburn?"
I want the guy that's going to make sure this gets.
But so that's all great. And I'm probably selling his, you know, motivation aspect short. Like, he's just kind of someone kind of just looking for his way through life and deals with things in a very no nonsense way. But and he's a great character, or whatever. But it just like. Despite its humor and, you know, it ends like you think it would end and everything like that. But just the whole thing is just kind of a downer because of the oppressive tone. I would really kind of put it toward the bottom end of the
Coen Brothers canon,
which is not a bad thing. I mean, it's better than most films.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's toward the bottom end.
Okay.
I'll give it 3 out of 5.
That's almost what I would have anticipated myself coming into it. Black Swan. Tonight, I'm going to talk about that. You talked about the Coen one. I'll talk about the Aronofsky one, though I will lead with this. I did not know this. And at the end credits, it was revealed to me. This is not one he wrote. He didn't adapt anybody's material. His name is not on the story or the screenplay. The screenplay has 3 people's names. The story has 1 of those persons' names. And I think it's a French dude. It's Andres something.
Okay.
That said, it's got the Aronofsky-ism that I think he started with Pi, and I think he might have kind of left behind when he... Let's see, what did he do? He did... I know it was definitely in Requiem. I don't know if it was in Fountain. But you know how he kind of gets that sort of jittery handycam, and he follows people behind them?
Right.
It's all over The Wrestler. It's in this film. It's a little bit in front. Pi was more in the front, and that was more jarring because it was like, you know, the guy's face. He might have been one of the first people to make use, at least in a movie, of that kind of hokey thing where you, like, the mount is on the actor or something. You know what I mean? Like, so it's kind of like the camera's right in their face. I could be wrong about that. I haven't seen Pi in a really long time. So, premise for Black Swan is pretty straightforward. I mean, a lot of people were gushing over it and being like, oh my gosh, it's great, it's intense, it's awesome. And I'm kind of rolling my eyes thinking, yeah, this is a psychological thriller.
Right.
I'd love it if he'd do something more interesting and maybe have there be... I kept joking with everyone on the internet. I'm like, did she really turn into a monster? Like, did she actually turn into a monster and it counts? Like, it starts ripping people in half and stuff. Because that would make it more interesting to me than just some metaphorical psychological thriller about somebody having a nervous breakdown because of the incredible pressure of being the lead dancer, you know, make your career kind of situation. That's exactly what it is. It's the latter. No monster in this. It's just all metaphor stuff about somebody's sense of self, basically. The theme is very straightforward in that sense. Natalie Portman plays this kind of quiet, kind of reserved dancer that's sort of been a worker. You know, she's shown up. She does her job. She's always in some portion of it. Her mother was also a dancer. There's something about how her mother... There's a little bit of creepy interaction with her mother, who's played... I think it's Barbara Hershey. Who's,
gross.
You know, she got... Yeah, I know. But it works. She, you know, she had her daughter, and that ended her career, so there's that sense of, like, living vicariously.
Right. And her blaming her and all that stuff.
A little bit. It's all there. It's not too soap opera. It's not hammered too hard. Thankfully, probably because it's directed by a dude. Hoo-ah, right?
Hoo-ah.
Ha. Al Pacino's in it? No. It would have been better. Al Pacino would have been better than Vincent Cassel. It would have been even more creepy when
like
he starts.
Vincent Cassel?
No, he was actually pretty good in this.
Wait, wasn't it Vincent Gallo?
No. It's your buddy Vincent Cassel.
Oh, good. Because I kept thinking it was Vincent Gallo, and I was like, gross.
Yeah, it's still That's gross because it's supposed to be, but Vincent Cassel does his, like, basic thing where he plays sort of a thug, but he's playing a thug that runs a ballet company. And I mean, it's about show. It's another show business movie. It's about, like, the backstabbing and the fear, the paranoia and the pressure of trying to get a position, trying to get your big break, and then dealing with that when it finally comes about. And for her, it's requiring a lot from her in such a way that she needs to be darker. She needs to be more dark to pull the character off in dance form. So the whole thing is about sort of her dark journey towards that. And then different scenes are, I guess, introduced through just psychological breakdown and fear. And that's where she has these hallucinations and stuff, and that's, you know, where all the, you know, the oomph and the action and the weirdness of the film come in.
How's her performance?
Her performance is pretty good. I would almost say that it's because it doesn't want to be a monster movie. It really shouldn't have done any of that. Like, it didn't need any of the CG. It didn't need any of the makeup of that,
right,
in order to still work as a pretty decent, albeit, you know, you get the joke, psychological thriller. I would compare it a lot to Perfect Blue.
Okay.
Though there's no murder angle. I mean, there kind of is, but not really. So yeah, I'd actually like to revisit Perfect Blue maybe sometime. That's the Satoshi Kon, right? I'm getting it right, the title?
Yeah.
Okay. About the actress, and so there's some similar elements there, just like somebody, I don't know what it is. I guess the genre is female suspense thriller, where it's a show business thing. It's its own sub-niche genre about the stress and the worry of a woman as,
do
like,
you think
treated both, like, as kind of an object in the business and other things too, you know?
So if it wasn't a woman, then it would be a different film.
Well, it usually is.
What film that's like this is with a male?
Like a suspense thriller?
Well, the exact type of...
Okay, let me think. I mean, like, it's somebody that's in a creative field and that's maybe harnessing the whole... what was that one? I think it was based on an F. Scott Fitzgerald story with Robert De Niro, where he was, like, head of a studio. Or one of the head guys of a studio. You know what I'm talking about? It's set in, like, the 30s or something. 40s or something.
With Robert De Niro?
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of with him is that someone high up in the studio is...
Hop on the IMDb. Anyway, there's elements of that to it. Maybe a little bit like Lost Highway, David Lynch with the saxophone player.
Right.
But no, I mean, there's just certain. It's different. I think that's sort of the point, is that it's like different to be a female in show business, and to pretend that it's like all gender equality is incorrect. Right. I mean, the same could apply for racial things and all sorts of other things. You know, someone. I mean, that was Dave Chappelle's big thing about like walking away from his show, is that he sort of felt that maybe people weren't getting the joke the right way, and felt like maybe he was being made foolish or something.
I don't know where to even look for this film. What year would you say it was in?
It would probably be in the mid-80s.
Mission, Brazil, Falling in Love, Once Upon a Time in America, King of Comedy, True Confessions, Raging Bull.
Okay, it'd be before all of that. I'd be after all that, after all that. Jesus, is it not on there?
Angel Heart, Untouchables, Midnight Run, Jackknife. We Are No Angels, Stanley and Iris, Goodfellas. That's through the 90s there. Down into the 90s.
Yeah, moving to the 90s.
Yes, Guilty by Suspicion, Backdraft, Cape Fear, Mistress, Night of the City, Mad Dog, and Glory.
Okay, screw it then. Go even later then. Maybe it's before.
Greetings, Samsung, The Wedding Party.
No, it's not in the 60s. It must be.
Jennifer Lawrence.
It's got to be in some.
Bang the Drum Slowly, Mean Streets, Godfather of the Deuce.
The Last Tycoon, that's it. A little bit like, I mean, it's not at all like that, but you asked for an example of a situation where a male is in sort of the big picture, Christopher Guest's film with, I think the go-to plot is somebody is an artist, a creative person, a performer.
Right.
They're finally given their big break. And something is required of them. Something is asked from them by the higher ups. You know, you need to do this. You need to do that. You know, could you change the story a little or whatever? And then it's their struggle with themselves and with their work and right. to arrive at that. And in this case, it's very straightforward. It's you're the ballerina and you and all your other bitchy ballerina friends, you know, all hate each other and whatever. And you all kind of look the same. I mean, I don't know. I've known maybe like one and a half girls that were kind of ballerinas at some point. I really couldn't speak to it. It's not a character I necessarily identify with or anything. But I mean, but you get the joke. I mean, it could be comedians for all I care, you know, and they're looking to get the Tonight Show or something. Right. Who knows? And so you have to pull off the role. You have to pull off the character. So it's that. It's nothing special. Visually, it's well done. Aronofsky does good things with a camera. I don't think he does anything particularly crazy and zany in this. I don't think I'm ever going to watch it again.
Do you think he's trying too hard
to do like important seeming stuff?
Yeah.
Yes. And that's my review in a nutshell. It's like, oh, great, you did one about a ballerina. Now why don't you go back to doing? Oh, come on, give it. You know, come on, RoboCop. I mean, you did Pie. Yeah. You did a nerdy movie that was kind of offbeat and indie. I want him to just have fun. I think he should be having fun because, honestly, his stuff has all been kind of good, but it's also been kind of, like you said, kind of down, kind of dreary, kind of pretentious. And I really want to think he's not that way. I think I saw a 60-minute thing one time years ago, and it was the year he was working on Pie. And he was the big, you know, underdog story there. You know, like they were like guerrilla shooting in New York, and meanwhile you had they juxtaposed Aronofsky, and then they with Vin Diesel doing that. Strays, and clearly the 60 Minutes was all pro Pie and kind of digging on Diesel, which whatever. I mean, it comes naturally, I suppose. But I mean, pretty much he did Pie, and then there was almost immediately talk of like you're going to do Batman or something, right? You know. Or maybe he did Requiem and then it was talk for that. I, for the life of me, couldn't really enjoy that movie. Requiem for a Dream just seemed like, first off, there was no reason to care about any of the characters. And so they were just like miserable drug addicts having miserable things happen to them. It just kind of felt like a big pile of comeuppance. But it was done in such a way that, I mean, you know, it was artistic and whatever. But I saw it once, I'm probably never going to see it again. If I feel like I've got too many endorphins in my system, maybe I'll watch Requiem for a Dream again just to balance me back out. And then The Fountain took me years to see. I really was excited by the idea of it. And then the execution again, it's just, it's like he reins himself in and he takes something that could be kind of weird and fun and then steps back from it and makes it more allegorical or something. And that's what happened in Fountain, where it could have been about, like, you know, immortality. It could have been about, like, what happens if someone continues to live, but instead it became kind of this bizarre love story with reincarnation and spiritualism and whatnot. And then The Wrestler was very straightforward. So I was like, okay, that's fine. That's go with it. It's indie. It's dingy. It's straightforward, though. You know, it's like, oh, okay. It's kind of like the other side of Black Swan, where it's like, now you've had your success and right. kind of, you know, that's the fear, right? And then Black Swan is what Black Swan is. I mean, he didn't write it, but he directed it, so it's well executed and it looks pretty good. But I really just want this guy to start doing, I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong about him, but I feel like just give him an Oscar so that he can start having fun. You know? It's like the same
path
I would
begets more Oscars.
I know. It's like the same path I would do, which is like just make a lot of like hoity stuff to hone your craft and get good with working with good actors and stuff, and then just have a lot of fun making movies and doing, you know, do RoboCop and do whatever you want, man. I mean, you always hear about him getting involved on these projects and then like they eventually get rid of him, you know, because he doesn't want to do something or something. It's almost like. And then he makes his next movie, and it's critically successful. And I don't know if they just don't make money or what, but they generally create something that's viable. And it's almost like, hey, studio dipshits, why don't you let him just, you know, give him one of these movies and let him do that? It'll be something different, and it might be really successful because of that. Like, if he did do RoboCop, it might be more interesting than if you gave it to, say, Brett Ratner or something. Right. You know what I mean? So what if he doesn't want to make it crappy, hokey 3D? If he wants to do things, maybe he probably insisted on practical effects, and that was like, no, we don't have the budget, not going to do practical effects, it's going to be 3D, digital blood, PG-13. And then he probably rolled his eyes and walked out. And you know what? More power to him. I've created this nice little heroic status for poor Darren Aronofsky, you know.
Probably doesn't deserve it.
No, he probably
doesn't. You know what's funny is that there's a certain type of character I like in movies. And it's somebody who's, like, simply motivated. They generally have some sort of, like, you know, they're stunted because of something in childhood, and then they always kind of revert back to a childish character. But, you know, it's part of their growth, whatever.
Yeah.
So, why don't we like Michael Bay more? Think about it. His movies are just all about explosions, right? There's something awesome about that. And there's something awesome about the idea of, like, when you first thought maybe you wanted to do something with film, maybe, I mean, but I don't know if you got into that later because you wanted to do the whole med school thing. Like, did you think about being, like...
I thought about it way before med school. That was my, like, that's what I really want to do, but this is what I should do.
So, I mean...
No,
when I was in my early teens, I was like, dude, I want to film stuff blowing up. That's awesome. That's what I want to do. And that was before I'd seen a Michael Bay film or anything. Michael Bay, the first thing he did, he got in huge trouble. He taped a bunch of explosives he found onto a toy train and drove it down the street, filmed with a Super 8, and it exploded and, like, hurt somebody. And, like, he was like, woo, like 8 years old, you know? Like, that's awesome. And now look what he's doing. He's making movies where stuff explodes.
Blowing up cameras.
Bigger and bigger and bigger.
Killing extras, like, and shit, yeah.
That's awesome.
No,
that's awesome. I love Michael Bay. I love Michael Bay. I love the idea of Michael Bay. I just don't want to watch his movies anymore.
I think the idea is one thing. I sincerely enjoyed The Rock.
Yeah.
As a film, it's good. It's fun. And the thing I got from that, back when I thought, when I was coming up, thinking I wanted to make movies, watching indie stuff and watching stuff like that and combining the two. Oh, you were the one that got the almond joy. Yeah. Well, thank you. You want some of it?
No, what did you think of it?
I don't know. I thought you were here playing with the kids.
Rachel's here.
When did that happen?
She's the one who came in. She was like, hi, and played with the kid and stuff. Rachel's been here for like 10 minutes, man.
Well, Kristen came in here.
Kristen just came in right now.
And had the kid.
No, that was Rachel. Kristen just came in right now. Kristen has not come back yet. You're having your own Black Swan moment.
I'm having a...
The stress has blown you up.
Oh my God. No way that this whole... Wait, what happened though? What were the altercations?
Kristen left.
I remember her leaving the second time. She gets back from...
She left the first time. She only left one time while you've been here.
Okay, that's right.
She was back. She left. She went to go get a book.
Okay, that's...
There was like 12 phone calls.
Yeah.
Which is always what happens this time of day.
I just never registered her showing up then at all.
Someone walked in. The person picked up Isaiah, was playing with him, talking.
But I never would have seen it. I was focused.
You looked back at one point. Like that.
But did I see the person?
I don't know. You looked back right at Rachel.
I never registered the Rachel Bussier.
And you were talking about something, you know, important.
Yeah, that's probably even why. Important. Yeah.
And then you look back and just kind of kept going, and then and now Kristen came back.
Okay.
That's been the secret.
So the whole thing is that I just never registered that.
Yeah.
That's all. Oh my gosh. Wow. That freaked me out. Yeah. no, but so with Michael Bay, the thing I thought was genius when I was a kid was the use of quick cuts to artificially amp action sequences.
Yeah.
But not like in a green grass hide the fact that your actors can't fight or whatever, but like in a it just pushes things. It's like jump cuts, exactly.
It's a way to artificially pump adrenaline.
Yeah, it pumps it into. Yeah, it's just, and I thought, well, you know, like from like an optic standpoint or like a physiological standpoint, like that makes sense. If you just cut faster than like the eye can really handle it to a degree. I mean, if you really think about it, motion pictures, you could play all kinds of really weird, you could really screw people up, you know? And it wasn't like I was coming up with some evil villain plan to do that or anything. I just thought, well, you know, for action sequences, that just makes sense that if you want to, you cut faster than people can register things happening necessarily, and it just creates that buildup. But, no, the reason, and here's my take. Most car chases, most explosions, most gunfights are boring to me. I don't get excited by those things unless there's something clever happening, different, the setting is interesting, it's being shot in a way that's interesting, or if they've done the freaking work to make it so, like, I really want this guy to succeed, or I really want this bad guy to get it. You know, if I don't care about the characters, it doesn't do anything for me. Right. I mean, Episode 5, Cowboy Bebop, a gunfight in a church. A gunfight in a church, if I don't care about what's happening or any of those characters, or I'm not interested in some kind of story that's being hinted at, I don't care. The reason why that, to me, is one of, like, the most awesome gunfights is because that of what it does about that does for that character. Right. First off, he's showing up ostensibly to save the girl, to rescue the damsel in distress. He's already said he doesn't care about that. It's just incidental. And then second off. Don't second off anybody right now. We're on podcast.
Okay.
But the second thing is that the character, who's for the most part been pretty jokey, I mean, other than like maybe the first episode where he was kind of serious, but for the most part it was kind of just like reacting to the things happening to him, mostly pretty light. You know, somebody's got a gun to some, you know, to the girl's head, and it's like normal situation, you know, it's like, okay, hostage situation, you have to like put the gun down, negotiate, whatever. It's like, no, immediately, there's never a moment in his mind where that has ever entered. He just focuses, and then he shoots the guy in the head without thinking about it at all. It doesn't even let him finish his sentence to like try to maybe negotiate. And you're like, that character that up till now hasn't really seemed like that kind of character just did that.
Right.
Now I'm going to pay attention to this. I mean, it sells you. Like that scene is why you would watch that show through a lot more other episodes where things get jokey again, because you're like, when are we going to get back to this angle on this guy?
Right.
So, I mean...
You know what's another awesome gunfight in church is in Shanghai Noon.
Well, I mean, I think that they got that gunfight in church from one of the John Woo movies, and I can never get it right. It's either The Killer or Hot Handed God of Cops or something like that. But there's... I mean, the gunfight in the church thing's been used before. So it all comes down to character, and it all comes down to story. And every case... And in Michael Bay's case, they're just... The characters are really hacky. They're very... they're stereotypical. They're there, like they're there to serve the purpose of being the comedic relief, or there to serve the purpose of being the sexy chick, or being the stupid guy that's running around freaking out about stuff or whatever. I mean, The Rock is the standout in that, because you've got like Sean Connery with a character that's like old, and he's got like a little character to him. You've got Ed Harris, who's interesting, and you've got like Cage being Cage, but it's like a good mixture of like crazy Cage with like. like nerdy Cage, and it works really well. Like when he's trying to disarm that first nerve gas thing, and the guy's like leg, dead body's leg, like leg, like twitches, and he's like, "Why is it doing that?" And then Sean Connery's like, "I don't know. It's just a reaction." He's like, "Make him stop." He's like, "What do you want me to do? Kill him again?" Like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Like the chemistry worked. I think a lot of that has to do with those actors. I don't know if it has to do with Bay. And I mean, so now he's just in Transformersville making money hand over fist. I don't know. That's why I don't... Because explosions for explosion's sake, spectacle for spectacle's sake, is never worth it.
I just like the idea that someone's still doing that out there.
Well, someone's always going to do that, and it's always going to make money. I caught a scene of... Oh, my gosh.
But that's all he does.
Yeah. But I caught a scene of Independence Day recently.
Yeah.
Oh, how? Talk about terrible...
Roland Emmerich likes explosions,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Where it's Vivica Fox, and they're in the tunnel, and the explosion's happening, and she's like calling the dog, and the dog like kind of like jumps over two cars while the green screen explosion like happens right and behind it.
It leaps into the tunnel as the
fire passes, as the dog like jumps past, and you're like, really? This was in a movie that is played for serious as early as when did that go, like 97 or something?
I don't remember. Yeah. I saw it in the theater, and when the dog jumped into it, and the fire passed him. Everybody cheered.
What's going on?
Wrap it up, people.
You wrap it up.
Yeah. Anyway, Black Swan, I give...
Oh, Henry's pretty good.
3 out of 5.
Shit, oh, Henry's?
I've never had it. Have you had
anybody
it?
Anybody else want the other half of this almond joint?
I think you'll have it, Ian.
Okay, thank you.
So what do you give it?
Black Swan? 3 out of 5. Well executed. It's effectively suspenseful, but you kind of know where it's going, and it kind of goes where it goes, and that's just the way it goes.
Hey.
Well, a lot of background noise in this episode.
It's a handful. Yeah, we're at a concert.
Yeah.
Just give me 1 second.
Okay.
At a party concert.